Thank you for listening to The Exit Interviews. These videos are a series of reflections captured through interviews undertaken by the Association of Anaesthetists Trainee Committee to gain an insight into how we can improve retention and equity within the anaesthetic training pathway.
One of the major conclusions I got from interviewing Chris, for example, was that it's so clear to me that he has incredibly fond memories of his work in anaesthesia, and it was a job that made him incredibly happy in his day-to-day. You can see the huge smile that he gets when he remembers, for example, doing his kids' ENT lists. One thing he said that I really picked up on was he mentioned the word agency and his lack of throughout training. And this, I thought, was really impactful. So much of your day-to-day, in terms of the people you work with, in terms of how you work, but also in the bigger picture, in terms of where you work, the decisions that are potentially made for you in terms of the time you have off, what hospitals you travel to, when you say exams, or timing for major life events are also made for you. We know that having agency is a core pillar of someone's well-being at work and their longevity to be able to thrive within it. But actually, we must realise that, especially in the early years of people's specialty training, we take all that agency from them. And I think that's a really important thing that we need to start thinking about.
Today we have Dr. Chris Smith-Brown with us, who has agreed to volunteer his time to tell us about his story of anaesthetic training and his life just now. So I suppose, Chris, what I'd first like to ask you is, can you just tell us a bit about yourself, your experience of training and what you're up to now?
Thank you, Stuart. I was a CT2 in anaesthetics until just over a year ago and made the decision to leave. I did the classic, I guess, F1, F2. I had a 6-month gap because I didn't get into anaesthetics the first time, and then got into core training on my second application. Spent 2 years within a core training kind of job, and then left. I spent a year post anaesthetics working for a healthcare consulting firm, and I now work for a government arm's length body that regulates private healthcare data in the UK as a clinical advisor.
I suppose my first question from that is, you're no longer in direct clinical care, but it clearly is something medically related. And was that important for you when you were moving?
Yes. I think when you make the decision to leave, you're almost justifying it in your head, and you really want it to kind of, I think part of why you become a doctor and part of why you become an anaesthetist, you want to help people, and you're also a bit selfish. You want that instant gratification of knowing you've helped someone every day. And that was really important to me. And my strengths lie in healthcare, my experience lies in healthcare, and I wanted to continue working on within that kind of closed periphery, but just not in a clinical capacity at the time. So yeah, it was really important to kind of take on a job that was still definitely within a healthcare setting.
And you sort of said there that you had a second attempt at getting into anaesthetic training. That sort of suggests to me that anaesthesia was definitely something you were set on. Is that fair?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I'll caveat this whole interview by saying that anaesthetics is the best specialty, and I always think that. And that hasn't changed. I think it offers a great experience to trainees. I think I always knew I wanted to do, actually no, I wanted to do A&E, and then it changed very quickly when I did an A&E placement in med school, and then I wanted to do anaesthetics. But yeah, it's something that I've always wanted to do kind of when I started applying for applications, and then unfortunately didn't get in the first time because anaesthetics is a competitive specialty. Spent 6 months working on my kind of application. I did a clinical fellow job where I worked basically as a CT1, and then was able to get into the same area, same region that I was working in. So it worked out really well.
And what was your experience like of recruitment there? Because obviously that sounds like there were a number of things that you had to do in order to eventually secure your training post.
I think it was interesting because I got to see, I think one of the last rounds of applications before COVID hit. And so I went to, was it the college? I did face-to-face kind of, you know, the round interviews, took my like bundle of portfolio with me. And I remember kind of that quite clearly. And then the second time I applied, COVID had hit. They had decided that it was all going to be, you know, virtual. They changed kind of what the portfolio weighting was going to be. And I mean, I thought both of them were kind of unfair, but I got to see it from different perspectives, I guess. But yeah, it's it's never fun, I think, applying for any specialty. I think the hoops you have to jump through, and I think we've seen in other specialties like surgery, they change the goalposts very short notice. So it's not a fun part of being a doctor, I think.
Yeah. I suppose you have a unique perspective because you've actually been recruited for other jobs now, right? And so what's your experience of recruitment out with, you know, for example, a training program?
It's almost like a 180 experience. It's so bizarre. Being a doctor is held in a real high esteem, and I don't think we see that because we're in it every day. My first interview process for all of, I was applying to consulting firms, and they were so appreciative of my time. They were so keen to like get me to join their firm. There was this whole kind of feeling of being wanted. The recruitment kind of officer, or even like the head of recruitment in the actual job I went for, was so keen to phone me after every interview and be like, okay, this person really liked you, this is going really well, like, here's, when can we do another interview? They're really engaged, trying to give feedback, make sure that I was invested in the process as much as they're invested in me. And I mean, we've all experienced Oriel, you know, just waiting and waiting, and then you get like a change in status, and that's it, and that's all the feedback you ever get. So it was a very different experience to feel valued and to recognize, I think, that you've done years of, you know, undergraduate education and postgraduate education and exams, and someone goes, yeah, you're smart, we want you.
It's interesting, isn't it, because I suppose during that process you can definitely feel just like a salmon swimming in the stream with all the other salmon, and it's almost like a process that's not made, it needs to make you feel not that special.
Yeah, you are definitely condensed down to a number, unfortunately.
I suppose there's an inherent difficulty there, though, isn't there, which is, you know, you've got a significant number of people that you have to fairly and objectively assess in order to get a number of jobs throughout the country. Lots of people talk about how recruitment used to be, which was far more sort of locally centred. It may have been a bit more personal, but potentially a lot more prone to bias as well. Although that is with the caveat that while it may have had bias, structural issues within the recruitment process, and let's face it, just mistakes, potentially happened less as well. I suppose, given your ability to compare both experiences, is there anything that jumps out at you which could be a potential change we could make?
I think what's frustrating is that we're told for national recruitment that, you know, there's lots of people, it's the only way we can do it, and then we have to use kind of exams or kind of, you know, random number generators to help sort us into groups and to kind of cut us off at interview level and then a selection level. And then when the evidence for them start to fall away, it can become very frustrating that you've kind of tried to, you know, study for an exam that isn't really an exam but kind of can be studied for, etc. Or you've tweaked your portfolio to get enough points and they've changed it at the last moment. And I think from consulting, because it was a firm or multiple firms that were kind of national organizations but still, like, you know, had local kind of recruitment processes to like the region you were working in, say London, and there was clear ownership of your recruitment process and people were reaching out to you and kind of just owning the process more. I think part of what seems to have come out of the, I think, 2021 kind of feedback or report about what happened internally for the recruitment period then is that you had, you know, poor band three and band fours in the NHS who just weren't empowered to deal with the recruitment process and it wasn't seen as a high priority. And I think that's reflective of maybe a lack of wider planning for anaesthetic trainees and how we manage anaesthesia in this country. So it's, I don't really think I have a magic bullet. I think it's just been a several years of lack of correct planning. And I think what was really important to me was being valued and being seen as a person rather than number. And I don't know how the NHS goes achieves that, especially now HE's been kind of absorbed into the NHS. It's hard. I think you have to find a halfway house between, you can't do locally kind of agreed anaesthetic recruitment because you'll end up with the biases, and unless there's a very clear appeal route for that, it just means that you'll end up where, you know, certain people recruit certain people and they exclude other people, and it just enables those biases with the medicine, and actually we need to find somewhere in between. But I still can't picture what that's quite like in my head.
That's, I mean, a good question, isn't it? I mean, I think that's the thing, but I think what I'm getting from you is that there's a process that didn't make you feel valued. And so once you were in anaesthetic training, did that feeling continue? Or actually, I mean, you spoke about a positive experience earlier on. So tell me a bit more about it.
Yeah, so anaesthetics is fun. It's a really fun specialty. You know, you go in every day and you learn a bit more and more, and you put people to sleep, and you learn about physiology and etc. And that's great fun. And what you get exposed to across hospitals is incredible. And that's what I think that everyone who does anaesthetics enjoys. I think things that start to creep in that were, I guess, maybe making me question it was COVID obviously hit probably as the time that I started my anaesthetic training. I'm not personally a big fan of ITU. I'm sorry, that's really controversial, but it's not my cup of tea. And I think that's probably when I started questioning anaesthetics. But I think generally I had a good kind of experience in CT1 in terms of like doing an anaesthetic list and kind of working through kind of the curriculum. But it's just all the other stuff that started to creep in that I was like, is this what being a trainee is for the next kind of minimum 7 years? And because anaesthetics isn't run through, reapplying at, you know, ST4 at that point was always on the back of my mind. And I'd already been rejected once, so I knew it was a possibility. So you're suddenly thinking, well, okay, my life is in someone's hands in 3 years time, and I'm probably gonna have to maybe move to another part of the region, depending on what jobs are available, because I know I'm gonna be up against that 700 lost kind of cohort during the transition from the old curriculum to the new one. So it's difficult. I think it's all the structural stuff around being a trainee that I found really frustrating, and actually being an anaesthetist is probably the easiest bit.
I mean, everybody, I think we could all say that actually the clinical work and the seeing patients and working with your colleagues and is the fun bit, it's the rewarding bit, isn't it? But I suppose, so it sounds to me like your clinical experience, and would I be right in sort of assuming from that in terms of teaching, supervision, hospital care, all that sort of stuff, did you feel well supported as an individual during that time as well?
Yes and no. I think I worked with some very good consultants. I worked with consultants who probably weren't as interested in teaching. And I think my department in particular had struggled. They'd had previous kind of supervision by HEE. They had not been in the best place, I think, when I joined. And so I think I had a very unique experience in terms of anaesthetic training. And it wasn't maybe in the nicest way, the healthiest department. But my college tutor was very driven, was trying to, you know, improve things and make our lives better. So I credit him. And my TPD was also very aware of the problems. So it wasn't like I was sitting there on my own in isolation. I think the association and the college were both aware that things weren't perfect.
Yeah. And there were people that were driven to create that change that were in the right places.
Yes. Yeah.
And I suppose what struck me there is that it sounds to me like during your core training, you had a sort of, I don't want to say doubts, but a sort of concept in the back of your mind about the next hurdle to jump in terms of recruitment and careers. And as you quite rightly say, you had a unique experience given the pandemic, in addition to the unique experience everybody was having. Can you tell me about the collection of factors that led to you eventually making the decision not to continue on with training?
So I think really basic stuff that as you start to progress, you know, you're getting more responsibility, but you still seem to lack kind of agency over your kind of career or even your day-to-day, and trying to, you know, if there are lists you're interested, or if you're constantly, you know, being pulled off the cover, kind of helping ITU, etc. It was frustrating. The annual leave, kind of study leave, trying to negotiate that. I was getting married in the end of CT2 and just before I left, and I was having kind of issues around annual leave, which is, you know, it's a big life event, and obviously it's, you know it quite a lot of time in advance and you're still kind of having discussions, which was frustrating. I think the exam weighed on my mind as well. My department was very keen for us to start as soon as possible, so I was already in kind of their little kind of exam cycle. So I had done the primary CIO by the time I started CT2. It was quite an intense kind of period. And then you're looking out at, you know, reapplying, doing the final, starting to think about, do I want to specialize? Is there any kind of projects I want to get involved with? It was just all the things that layer on as a trainee. And then in COVID, you start thinking about the difference you make. And I think the blessing and the curse of anaesthetics is you have a one-to-one kind of relationship. And when you look at kind of other people outside of direct healthcare, they were being able to make a change and make an impact, but on a bigger scale, they're able to kind of help, you know, either within like NHS leadership or kind of external organisations. There's an opportunity to still kind of make a difference, but in a different way. And that's what kind of really, I think, all started to get me thinking that maybe isn't what I want to do for the rest of my life. Especially when you look at consultants who, bless them, they were tired. Like the entire time I think I was in training, they just all seemed exhausted. And that makes you wonder, is being a consultant what it's cracked up to be?
So I'll put a pin in a sort of experience as a consultant, because I think that's really useful and we can circle back to that. But yeah. One thing I think you mentioned, which is really interesting, so lack of agency. I think it's a clear thing that so many human beings require in order to thrive, isn't it? The ability to, in some way, have an impact on the environment around you. And I suppose, in a sort of devil's advocate way, lots of people would say that within the NHS, as any practitioner, you have the ability to create a change within that environment. Now, the actual lived practice of that as a trainee is arguably different. What I'd be quite interested in is, in terms of the agency you felt you had at the time as an anaesthetist in training in a training programme versus the job you have now, can you compare those for me?
Yes. So I categorically have more agency over my work and life kind of now than I did as an anaesthetic trainee. I guess when you enter anaesthetics, you almost revert back to a med student, because it's, you know, it's basically a postgrad specialty. There's a steep learning curve, and you spend, you know, that first 3 months even just, you know, learning how to draw up drugs the right way. And so I think it puts you quite easily in a position of being feeling very junior in a team and kind of struggling to kind of, yeah, you can bear, you're not sure what to do each day to day, let alone suddenly take on a massive transformational project within a department and be like, okay, I know what we need to do to solve this. Whereas what I do now is that I get to kind of set my own work plan. I get to agree with kind of other managers in my kind of organization about what are the priorities. I get to, you know, book annual leave a year in advance, more, if more, not more. I get to kind of set my working day. Like if I want to work from home, I can. If I want to work in the office, it's all these little things that suddenly just add up, and I have so much more control over my life than I feel like I did as a trainee. So yeah, it's a shame, because I know it gets better when you are more senior as a reg. I know that, you know, it is a lot easier. And as a consultant experience is very different to a trainee. I totally understand that. I'm not naive, but you still have to go through training. Like, it's not, yeah.
And I suppose that leads us on quite nicely to your observed experience of consultants, because I suppose people might say, as you've just said, which is, you know, people feel there's a necessary, very intense part where there's a number of hurdles, arguably whether that should be the case or not. Maybe you get a bit more choice and freedom in space the more senior you get, if you get there. Your observation of consultants, given that really you're training in a job to become a consultant anaesthetist, presumably that must have been a big factor in you deciding to leave training, because ultimately the decision you've made is not that you don't want to be an anaesthetist in training, because the point is that you eventually migrate out of being that, but you've made a decision not to become a consultant anaesthetist, or, for example, a senior SAS doctor. And can you tell me a bit about that thought process?
So I think, like, first of all, like, as a consultant, you're still an on-call rota, and it's significantly less, but there is still a responsibility to come in, you know, nights, weekends, and then come in and then still have to do a list the next day, or hope that a colleague can cover you, because the expectation is, you know, that generally nights are quiet, so it'll be fine. And I think looking at what happened in COVID, kind of anaesthetists got drafted into kind of support critical care, and the risk that, you know, that could happen again as a pandemic, then getting to a consultant, you know, that anaesthetists are quite lucky that they can take on a lot of roles within hospital organisations, but there doesn't seem to be the biggest investment in leadership training as a trainee. You're almost expected to, you get your CCT, and now you start learning how to be a leader within the NHS, and now you start learning how to manage those kind of conversations or those structures within your organisation. Especially if you've never been a trainee there and you've managed to get a consultant job there, it's quite a bizarre system, I think, because, you know, consultants are ultimately responsible for kind of, you know, large pots of money within the within the NHS, like responsible for managing, you know, multiple juniors. They take on a really senior managerial position and they aren't supported for it. And then they're expected to take on more and more. And we've seen, I think, the responsibility, for associate anaesthetists going on to consultants, and then similarly with PAs for consultants, that there's just a similar to, I think, doctors generally, just that they will always take on that responsibility. And it doesn't seem like they're empowered or given enough kind of support sometimes. The same with education. I think there's an expectation, there's a requirement, sorry, under the GMC that we will be good educators. But I don't think that reflects necessarily kind of what some consultants want to do, and that's fine. I don't think all consultants want to be kind of specifically like teachers, etc. But I think we should recognise that some consultants are very good at it, and they should be given a lot more kind of time and support. And it just felt like all of these things that I would be expected to do as a consultant and would be expected to do for the next 20 years of my life were not being given what I thought was the appropriate support. And then I don't want to dwell on pay and pensions too much, but then financially you're being penalised for a lot of it as you get towards retirement. And then I'm seeing now on Twitter, even consultants only 3 or 4 years since getting CCT who are receiving like brown envelopes. So it just felt like everything was moving in the wrong direction, and it wasn't a career that I thought it was when I started med school.
And I'm about to blankly refer to a graph I've seen, which I don't know the name of it, but it was essentially a graph of happiness at work, and it was your responsibility versus your influence within your workplace. And if you have lots of responsibility but minimal ability to influence, actually you are the least happy amongst everyone.
Yes.
So let's talk about the time when you were making the decision to no longer continue training. Is that something that you had a chat with your supervisors, college teachers, etc.? Did you think you had sort of support in that? And sort of what was the thought process?
So I finished primary in February 2022. Yeah, so last year in February. Yeah, and then I came out of it being a bit like, was this worth it? I was very happy, actually. I was happy I was passed, but I was a bit like, okay, what's next? And I didn't talk to anyone at work at my department about it at all, because I was very much it felt a bit heresy to be like, I want to leave, or I'm considering leaving. And I don't think any specialty takes it well. I think everyone thinks, why'd you leave your specialty? So I never discussed it with any of the consultants in my department, and I think I only told the trainees once I had a definitive kind of job offer. But I did talk to so I leaned on my partner a lot. So my husband works in corporate environment, has done so since university, and was very much a good sounding board for, you know, the grass isn't always greener, this is kind of the rubbish that I deal with in an office job, which was really useful. And I think we talked about all the reasons I wanted to leave, and that was very helpful. I had some friends who worked in consulting who were able to kind of give honest feedback on, is this worth it? Is this a good job opportunity? And then I was having meetings with my TPD, and she was very kind of supportive of, I think, concerns I was raising. I was able to be a lot more, I think, open with her, and we're probably meeting probably 3 or 4 weeks really, just to chat about how things are going. And she was trying to find solutions, unfortunately constrained by the system that is, you know, training, but she was doing her best to work out any way that we could kind of address the problems I was raising, all the doubts I was having about anesthetics. And yeah, there are probably a couple of people I leaned on, I think, during the initial process.
So it sounds like you definitely got a good amount of support, both sort of personally and professionally throughout that. And I'm keen to know, what is your life like now? So in terms of, if you think about what you're weekly schedule might have been as an anaesthetist in training versus what your week is like now, you know, the logistics, the nuts and bolts of it, and also some of the things that you get reward from in your day just now that maybe you didn't before, or vice versa, things that you maybe miss from career in medicine.
So I think in terms of, I guess, what my day would have been like, it's, you know, I would have been just finishing what with the 1st of August actually, so maybe rotating to my last block, probably doing some more ops, or maybe doing a bit going back to ITU. It would have been classic, like, you know, shifts and negotiating with the rotor. I would have changed rotors, obviously, as I'm sure we all would have around this time of year, and negotiating leave during that period, and flipping from, you know, days, long days, nights. And then depending on, I guess, how crazy I was thinking, maybe starting to study for the final. But that's probably, oh yeah, and strengthening application for ST4 at that point. Because now I work a 9-to-5 job, or generally, like, it was probably more 8-to-6 with consulting, and occasionally some late evenings. Now, because it's basically a government, like, civil service job, I work kind of 8 to 5 really. It's Monday to Friday, all my annual leave's planned. I day to day will, you know, have quite a few meetings where we set like an work in sprints in my organization. So every 2 weeks we're setting kind of what's going to happen in the sprint, we set the priorities, we talk about kind of key tasks we want to deliver, and then I also talk to, like, kind of external stakeholders that are involved in private healthcare. I've got a couple of conferences that are coming up that I'm going to be presenting at, so kind of working on some data analysis for that, and then testing it with some of our, like, stakeholders. And then there's a few, like, projects that I work on as well. So it's quite varied, but I get my nights, weekends back. I still get to do something that's very using my clinical knowledge, just not in a clinical kind of front, kind of day-to-day situation. And that's hard. People who've asked me, when I talk to people who want to leave, that is the hardest thing, is that being a doctor or practicing medicine is such a privilege, and being able to be with with patients every day is so wonderful. And doing procedures, being an anaesthetist is great, and it's very hands-on, and that practicality is so wonderful. And it's really easy to see the impact you have. The moment you step away from that and you go into a office job or a corporate job, it's really hard. Then you've lost sight of patient, you've lost sight of any kind of impact, and it really becomes about, okay, what are the goals? What do I want to achieve? How do I know this is going to make a difference or make an impact in, you know, in healthcare or in an organization? And that is hard, and it can be really frustrating when you're looking at a spreadsheet and you're just like, is this worth it? So there's a balance, and I think the biggest thing I miss is probably pediatric lists. They were the funnest lists I would do. Everyone, ENT surgeons are incredible. There's something about them. They're just so much fun to work with, and kids are so much fun to do those lists. So yeah, that's something I do miss, and it's got less, I think, as, you know, time goes on. But I definitely, I was doubting myself for a long time in the first couple of months, and my manager was very observant in my first job, which was like, if you're having doubts, like if you're starting to crash, please talk to me because I want to address these. I want to make sure that you're happy. And that was really nice again for them to, I think, recognize that that was a possibility and also see me as an individual within their company rather than just a number.
And you know, clearly it sounds like you got a huge amount of support from the college that you had at the time. Well, this is a really difficult question I'm going to ask you, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If that individual at the time said, I can offer you anything, so I can make any changes to what your day-to-day life is like, I can make any changes to what your future training schedule is like, I can guarantee you a specific consultant job at the end of it, or I can give you a year away to come back, or, you know, anything. Are there any things that you think actually those fundamental changes may have meant that I would have wanted to continue on?
Yeah, I think if she could have offered me a department that I was willing to commute to, that was maybe in a better shape. And I think there's some whole scale kind of wider structural issues with training, like rotational training, I personally don't agree with. But I think if she could offer me maybe a different department and we could talk about kind of certain issues around trying to get certain things, training within what I wanted to like focus on, what I saw was important, such as like improving like my regional anesthesia or getting more like pediatric lists, then yes, I think there could have been a conversation there. But I think we were so limited by what she could offer me, and I think there was one hospital that would add another 45 minutes to my commute that was even being contemplated, and I would still have to wait for kind of rotations. I couldn't, there was no discussion of me going straight away or anything. And that's what I found frustrating, is it was just so inflexible. Like I was saying that I'm not happy, I want to do something different, and it was still like, well, you've got to wait. And that was like, okay, well, I've got to take the decision to my own hands then.
Yeah. Well, and I think actually that speaks again to one of the first sort of themes you mentioned, which is agency, because actually leaving is sort of, I don't want to say the ultimate act of agency, but it is a very true act of agency in that regard, which is, this is a decision I can truly make for myself, and isn't necessarily dictated by a limitation of options of things that I'm being offered. What I'd quite like to ask you about is so non sort of traditional structured training programs. So the classic being people employed as either SAS doctors or locally employed doctors, Caesar routes, for example, or sort of what's becoming more prominent now are lots of these posts where somebody's employed and they're sort of almost guaranteed Caesar competencies and investment in them by that trust or health board, depending on where you are in the UK. In comparison to, I suppose, the guarantee of a training programme, but also the rigidity of a training programme, do you think that would have, if that was a sort of more equitable pathway or more popular, do you think that would have made a difference for you?
Yeah, I think if there was a hospital that was 10 minutes away from where I lived that I desperately wanted to work at one day, and if they could have had been in the position to offer me a SAS job and said, we'll look after you, you'll stay here until you see her, if you you'll get to, you know, be in that department forever, or you'll get to, you know, as long as it works for you, like geographically, that would have been great. Yeah, it's that flexibility and being able to stay in one place and plan your life would have been absolutely kind of brilliant. But unfortunately, it just, that option wasn't there. They just didn't have kind of, they were a very popular department, so it just wasn't possible. And then I didn't really feel like I wanted to go and start moving around other departments. It just felt like starting again almost, because I was still, I guess I'm still quite junior within like the anaesthetic training program, and I've already at that point I've been in two or three departments. It's kind of like you're just, yeah.
And I suppose clearly you still work very hard and at a very high level, but we recognize that the life of a medic, there is a certain work-life balance that's almost expected. And to be fair, there are multiple benefits to it. I love a sort of, you know, random Tuesday off.
Yes.
But what's your reflection on work-life balance that you have now versus at the time, or of sort of medical community in general?
I mean, I definitely miss those random days off. It's so annoying when, you know, I have to do everything now on the weekends, and when I couldn't do it on a random Tuesday, I definitely, I do miss those perks of training. But I don't think the work-life balance is great. You know, our contracts presume at above, you know, normal kind of average working week. And so it's already stacked kind of against everyone. You add in kind of nights and weekends and that kind of disruption. And especially depending on the rotor on the intensity. And then you add in studying exam. I think studying for the primary, it's just you'll accept it, or everyone's just, you know, okay, well, I'm not going to see anyone for three months. You know, I'm going to hide away and try and study for the primary. And that's just completely normal behavior within anesthetics. Whereas now I have a much better kind of work-life balance. I see my husband a lot more. I see friends. I'm able to kind of do stuff that I want to do on the terms that I want to. I can go on holiday whenever I want. It's just a much better situation to be in, and I feel better for it, which is such a shame because I feel like it's such a really bad indictment of my training experience. But I would find it really difficult to go back to kind of, I think, a training role now unless something had significantly changed. And unfortunately, looking at the data, it doesn't. And talking to my, you know, friends who are still anesthetic trainees, it hasn't changed. It's, if anything, some people it's got worse.
So clearly there's so much about being an anaesthetist that you loved.
Yes.
And clearly, like you're saying, you know, there's so much that the career can offer people, but it seems like it's the infrastructure within which we train anaesthetists can usually be some of the problem, and that rigidity of that structure. Do you think, in what ways do you think we could make it more flexible? I'm just thinking about all the different lifestyles of people, or, you know, personal circumstances of people, or their own health circumstances, or actually in a sort of modern day where most people are looking to have a sort of good quality of life experience as well as whatever their profession is. Are there ways that you think the training structure that you were in could be changed in order to benefit all those aspects?
There's a couple that would, I think, make a big difference to trainees' lives. I think run through training, being able to offer that as a college, or to support that even as a college, would be quite useful. I think having the confidence that, you know, you're in the same place for an extended period of time, and you can kind of plan your life for a couple of years at least. I think, as I said earlier, I don't like rotational training. I used to think it provided lots of benefits and you got to see how everyone does everything. But, you know, being very cynical, it's a big syringe, it's a little syringe. I think there is actually a lot to offer in having trainees for several years and being able to look after them and nurture them. And I think that responsibility also doesn't have to rely on an entire department. I think there is, again, I think I probably mentioned it as well, but being a educationist, like anaesthetist, should not be an expectation of everyone. I think actually it should be invested and rewarded by kind of, you know, organizations and encouraged to support that training. And I know we see it in like the IAC period where, you know, usually a department will have a small group of consultants that will look after those trainees. But I do think there's more that can be done to improve like the educational experience of trainees and departments. I think exam, especially the primary, I think I saw some papers about the validity of the MCQ, and I didn't even read them because I didn't want to go down that train of thought. But I definitely don't always understand the relevance of what we have to learn, and especially be able to kind of almost power at the like SME or the Viva. And the ALCPs, they're just, I don't understand why you're made to jump through these hoops, which can be changed at the last minute, and then they're all done virtually, and you're not even expected to attend. So it's all hinging on an email or maybe a message from your TPD, and that completely depends on your relationship with your school as well. So it's, I think if you could maybe do run through training that is condensed, I'm not sure, maybe 7 years is too long if you look at other countries, and then if you could maybe make the ASAPs a lot less onerous, and that actually it's just more a check-in to make sure you are progressing rather than these very arbitrary like barriers, and then reduce rotations as well. I think that's probably things that I would do to improve what I think a trainee's life.
Yeah. I think there are so many things you mentioned there that are entirely relevant. Length of training is some of the longest in the world. And inevitably, when people want to specialise after the CCT, most people do a post-CCT fellowship anyway, so actually even further extend training. So could you shorten that to remove some of that specialty time? Rotations. On you go, Chris, sorry.
So it's the length of training is funny because the threshold for UPs, for taking time out of a program, for going less than full time, it feels quite high and quite onerous on the trainee. And anecdotally, obviously, I talk to people who also have these like doubts about training, so maybe it's biased, but I feel like if it wasn't so high, you would keep trainees. I feel like if you were just like, oh yeah, you want to go 60%, fine, let's do it. You know, we're gonna have to start our rota with locums anyway, so we may as well keep you and invest in you. I find it really short-sighted the way that we treat kind of trainees when they want to do other things, and then are then expected to become a consultant and take on, you know, clinical governance, etc. And they've haven't had the opportunity because they've had to turn down an UP or something. It's just, short-sighted. It's probably how I feel.
It sort of reminds me of a thing that I was told by the first consultant anaesthetist I was on a list with on day one of CT1, and he said, I take my training of you and my investment in you very seriously because I'm training a future consultant anaesthetist. And I think that sort of summarized to me that somebody said, I want you to be in this career for the long haul, and therefore I'm invested in you as an individual. And being part of a formal training program that you competitively get into, and as we've discussed, there are a number of things to succeed in and thrive in throughout a number of years, you would hope that a number of those options, decisions, flexibility would be open to you. But as you're quite right, it seems that anecdotally thresholds for those things are quite high. I suppose if you reflect on it now, what were your highlights of being an anaesthetist in training?
I mean, not to brag, but I think passing the primary first time was, I think people really hype it up, and understandably so. And I know lots of people who fail multiple times, but it was kind of, it was nice to go, I've done it. And you come away from it like, okay, I can talk about all these strange and wonderful facts about gases that, it was a great moment like to pass. And it really felt like a rite of passage kind of as a, like an anaesthetic trainee. I think for the first time you're kind of in A&E, like running kind of a situation where someone's really ill and everyone looks at you, I think that's a big moment as well. Like you're suddenly the person that they're calling to come and help. And that's definitely a, oh wow, I'm the only person in this room that can do a certain task, or and then I think I said earlier, but paediatric lists, I find them so much fun. I really enjoyed them, and I valued the time, especially with the consultants who did that. The paediatric anaesthetists are such a special breed, and they're so much fun to kind of work with. So yeah, that's probably a couple of highlights.
So Chris, I suppose if I were to summarise, I get the impression that the experience of co-training for you was something you enjoyed and you got a huge amount out of clinically. But it feels to me like the rigidity of the framework you were in and the inability of you to be able to really dictate not only the way you lived your life in terms of your free time and dictating annual leave or the hospitals you worked in, but also the clinical experience you got were fairly big factors in the decision you made for the future about the career you wanted to have and the life you wanted to have. Is that fair?
It's a great job. It's just being a trainee, I think, is very challenging, and I don't think the experience is equal across the country as well, and that's what makes it really hard. But I would still recommend anaesthetics as a specialty. I just think you have to have a very open conversation about the limitations of being a trainee at the moment to anyone that I'd kind of recommend.
I agree. I mean, I do love anaesthesia and critical care, and I kind of enjoyment out of it. I suppose part of the reason that we want to start speaking to people like you is we want good people, and we want people that love the specialty to be able to thrive in the specialty. And if there are modifiable parts of that framework that we can change in order to keep more good people in, then we should. Not regularly exit interviewing people who leave training at any point in training means that I suppose we don't really get that wealth of information and reflection, which is clearly, as an individual leaving training, that person has, you know, many hours and hours and hours of thoughts about what their training experience is and what they want their future to be. So clearly that's a huge wealth of a brain to tap into to say, you know, how could we improve this? So Chris, unless you've got anything else that you want to add, I think we'll probably conclude our conversation there. Thank you very much for spending your time. Incredibly interesting. I would hope that the people viewing and listening to this have got something out of it and maybe have a think about either their own training experience or as a trainer of anaesthetists about how we can maybe start to have a conversation about modern anaesthetic training and how we train our anaesthetists in the future. Thank you.